Good evening, everyone. So today we're going to talk about a still mind and open heart. I'm not sure what is your understanding on this topic. Anyone have any thoughts about this topic? Then you can come and talk about it. Right, so what is a still mind? What is your understanding on a still mind?
A peaceful mind.
A peaceful mind?
Calm.
A calm mind?
Mind that doesn't wander.
Mind that doesn't wander? Okay, so it doesn't move. Okay. So, a still mind, a lot of times they say, is a, yes, a mind that doesn't move, unmoved mind, a quiet mind, a peaceful mind, a calm mind, a tranquil mind, right? Or sometimes, so when it's a mind that's not moved, does it mean that there's no feeling? It's supposed to be no feeling, right? Quiet, still. Still, always say, you are very cool. So still, right? So, all right, first, that's what general people talk about, still mind. Then what about an open heart? What does it mean by open heart? Could a doctor open it up? What does it mean by an open heart?
Accepting.
Accepting? Embracing?
Kind.
Kind, yes.
Even compassionate.
Compassionate, yes. So an open heart. What else?
Open to anything that comes.
So open to anything that comes. Okay, very broad-minded, is it? Flexible. Okay. That is your definition.
It sounds a bit emotional to me, but I know emotional is not a so good thing, but...
Yeah. So a person who is more passionate, more sentimental, is it?
Yeah, more sentimental.
They sort of have a stronger sense of feelings towards others.
Driven by...
Yeah, when they see someone in suffering, they cry. Kind of people as such, is it? So a bit more emotional in a sense. There are some people who are more cool who say, yes, I feel sorry, but not that emotional. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
All right, so these are general understanding on the two words, all right? I'm not talking about Buddhism. A definition, yes, as yet, but at least it's good because then we know how people think about an open heart. Do you use the word open heart very regularly?
More like open mind.
Open mind, okay. But open mind and open heart is different. Open mind is like more broad-minded, you're more accepting to different views. But now it's the heart that's open. All right, so. So maybe open heart, well, as some of you say, is more passionate, more compassion, more embracing, more welcoming, open, right? More caring. So one is that an still mind and open heart. Can two of them work hand in hand? You have a mind that's unmoved, not moving. Still, and then you have a heart that's very welcoming, very passionate. Can these two work together?
Maybe.
Okay, all right. So how can we have a still mind and at the same time have an open heart? Is it possible?
With equanimity.
Equanimity? What is the definition for equanimity? Have you heard of the word equanimity?
No attachment.
No attachment? Then when you have no attachment, how can you have passion to others?
It can be nice, but just not have any attachments. Like, you can be kind and loving, but not... affected by it if you don't receive it back.
Okay. Everyone agree? All right. So, right. First, let's talk about how can we have we all like to have a mind which is peaceful, that's not that fluctuating, but at the same time, we hope that we can be a person who can give others support as well. So how can these two go hand in hand? That's something very important. Okay? So is still mind contradict to an open heart? Or when we say someone attained the noble state, a nirvana, is nirvana contradictory to compassion? What is nirvana? Do you know what is nirvana?
Enlightenment.
Nirvana? Enlightenment? Nirvana is usually a description of the state of mind, which is peace and tranquil, unmoved, still, is a state of mind as such. So, a lot of people say someone enter nirvana, enter parinirvana, and that's the end. So where's compassion then? So can someone who entered nirvana still have compassion?
Yes. Just a quick question.
Yeah.
What is compassion really? Is that loving others?
Yes, compassion, loving kindness and compassion. In Buddhism, we say loving kindness is to make other people happy, to give happiness to others, right? You like to see others happy, so you always wish others to be well and happy. Whereas compassion is more of relieving others from suffering. They are similar. They like other people to be free from suffering. But compassion is more that when you see someone is in suffering, you hope to relieve the person from suffering. But having a loving kindness is you always wish everyone to be well and happy. Not necessarily the person is in deep suffering. Okay?
But by definition, if you want someone to be free from suffering, there's no attachment to it because you just want to help them.
Mm-hmm.
There's no sense of clinging on that. So I guess in a way, from face value, it doesn't conflict with nirvana.
But then that feeling that, this person is in suffering, I need to relieve. Sometimes you feel, that's why you feel that the person is in suffering, that is a feeling. And a lot of times, like what he said just then, some people are more passionate, they are more emotional, like when they feel people in suffering, they like to help, at the same time they cry together with the person. There are people as such.
Yeah.
And that's when you find that after you help the person, you go back home, you feel so sad, or you feel so touched, or you feel you can't sleep yourself.
Yeah, so I think that way. So I think nirvana and compassion doesn't really exist. Like, they can't go hand in hand. Well, that's what I think. I know I'm wrong, but...
Mm. Well, that is the general... Yeah, that's it's quite true. I mean, that's actually from our ordinary level, that's how it usually is. Sometimes you go to your friend's house and help their friend to solve an issue or a sad incident or something. When you come back home, you can't sleep for the whole night yourself. So then you can't say, my mind is not being touched. I'm just helping relief from suffering. But why can't you sleep? So, how can we have a still mind and continue to care for others? Now, before we talk about how to have a still mind and continue to help others, we probably want to define a bit more on what is a still mind. So a still mind basically means that a person who can be free from... The mind is not fluctuating. So a person who is able to maintain peacefulness and calmness and free from attachment. And your mind can be at that state. And usually this refers to people who already attain enlightenment. Okay, so the mind, basically they have free, they have understood the truth of the phenomena, the truth of suffering, the truth of themselves, and that's why when they help, they see the truth, they don't get emotional into it. But at the same time, they're able to see that the person who is in suffering, probably because of not realizing the truth, feel the suffering as real. So they try to help out of compassion to help them, but then they themselves, their own emotion are not being fluctuating with it, because they are able to see the truth. Okay, so how can a person have a still mind? Well, a still mind basically is actually referring to an enlightened mind. Still continue to care for others. So this, to talk about this, I probably need to explain to you how we practice. Now, so if we draw a line, okay, so we are ordinary level. So we are all here, okay? Now, we say that there are different types of people. When they practice, they develop different type of mind. Some people, after listening to the Buddha's teaching, they feel that life is full of suffering. The cause of suffering comes from our self-attachment, our greed, our hatred, our jealousy, our arrogance. So the Buddha says that if we can eliminate these causes of suffering, we can be free from suffering. So they develop this mind that they want to be, to renounce from these afflictions. So they want to be free from these afflictions so that they can realize the truth and free from suffering. Right, so we say that they develop the mind of the renounced mind. The renounced mind is not just shaving off the head and become monks and nuns. It's basically the determination to renounce from affliction. All right, to renounce from greed, hatred, ignorance, arrogance, jealousy, selfishness, and so on. Okay, so they develop the renounced mind. So once when they develop this mind, it's not just a 3 minutes or a 3 days determination. It should be someone who, after listening and teaching, who really make firm determination that they want to follow this path. So they develop this renounced mind, and then they start to practice according to the Buddha's teaching, the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, right? Understand the teachings of impermanence, the teachings of selflessness. Have you heard of all this teaching? Right? Impermanence, you probably know that everything is subject to change. So the Buddha tells us to observe things around us. Why do we have so much attachment? Because we do not realize that, in fact, things are subject to change. It's not necessary to cling on to them like you don't want it to change forever, and that's going to give yourself more frustration. Understand that things are subject to change. And secondly, the Buddha say everything is selfless. Everything is actually non-self. What does he mean by non-self? Now, self. The definition of self is basically that this thing is a fixed entity, is permanent, is independent by itself, and is self-mastery. So a self, or I, has the characteristic of permanent, independent, self-mastery. But do you think that we have that characteristic? Are we an independent entity, not relying on any conditions at all? If you look into yourself, you're not just one thing. You got your intestine that digests your food, right? You got eyes and ears and nose and everything. And so we are conditioned. We are relying on many, many conditions. So we are not a fixed entity as what we thought. We are a combination of many causes and conditions. And secondly, these conditions are always in the process of changing. They are impermanent. If it is permanent, it's not necessary for you to take a breakfast and your lunch and your dinner and then go to the toilet and then shower. You should always be the same. Why do you need to bother to do all the same? If everything is permanent, then you can't even drink that cup of tea. Even if you drink it, if the tea is also permanent, then you got big trouble. Is that right? So, in fact, everything is impermanent. That this I is impermanent, is causes and conditions, and are we self-mastery? Are we the master of ourselves?
As in, are we able to control
everything,
our mind and everything, and
yeah,
how things fall apart?
Yeah. No, so we try to develop our mind so that we can control our mind. But this I is not just the mind only. Some people talk, Buddhism talk about mind is very important. Yes, mind is very important. But mind can only function when you have this physical body. So it's a combination of body and mind. You tell yourself not to fall sick. Especially when exams come and say, I got no time to be sick. Then the virus come at you. So it basically shows that we are, and you tell yourself, I like to stay like you, so beautiful, so young. But can you? Every year it's passing by, right? So we can't control and tell ourselves, can you still stay at the cell like the 18 years old cell all the time? You can't, isn't it? So, we are not self-mastery, we are not permanent, we are not an independent entity. So, the Buddha wants us to understand this truth. And that's why he used a negation method to say this is non-self. It's not saying that this self disappears. A lot of people say, why Buddhism talk about non-self all the time? That this body and mind is here, we are living, we're walking around, why you say there's no self? Because we tend to get confused with the English words of no or non as like disappear, as like it become nothing. But the non is actually because the truth that the Buddha wants to tell us is beyond description of words. And so he can only try to use an example of a negation method for us to perceive that truth that's beyond description. For example, the state of nirvana. He can only say that it's a state that's free from chaos, free from suffering, free from... He's trying to take away all those things, but he can't describe that state of nirvana. Because that state of nirvana is an absolute state that's beyond description. Because when we use word to describe, it falls into relativity. You say free from suffering. Why do we say suffering? Because there's something as happiness. It's relative. Why do we say she's beautiful? Because she's comparing with me, so therefore she's beautiful. Right? So it is always relative. Did you realize that the words has its limitation? If I say, if this cup of water, is it hot or cold? It's very difficult for you to describe this if there's no comparison. Somehow you will set a standard in your mind that hot means if it's like 80 degrees or where it hurt my tongue, then I say that it's hot or something. You have to set a sort of a standard for yourself. If there's no standard, if it's just it's just one thing, it's really difficult to say whether it's hot or cold. We set a line. We say above 50 degrees, you call it warm. Above 80 degrees, you call it hot. Is that right? Zero, you call it as a freezing point. We mark it for the convenience of ourselves. So that's why do not misunderstand what does mean by non-self. Non-self is not saying that there's nothing at all. It basically means that everything arises in the causes and conditions, they are always in the process of changing. But because of our wrong understanding, whenever we see something, causes and conditions together, we tend to hold on to it from the appearance and then start to attach to it. What we are attaching to, we a lot of time we just fall into the trap of seeing the superficial appearance and then attach. We didn't see the true nature behind. Does it make sense? For example, I give this example a few times in the CDT, that when you look at a cloud in the sky, you see all this sky, there's a cloud, the cloud. Sometimes it looks like an elephant. Sometimes it looks like an aeroplane. Sometimes it looks like a Santa Claus. Then we immediately box it up. This piece looks like a Santa Claus. This piece looks like a monkey. Is that right? Sometimes when you've got nothing to do, you look at the sky. And then you can... And sometimes you can argue with a friend. No, it looks more like one. Yeah. We box it up. But for us, the cloud, although we say that it looks like an elephant or a lion or a monkey, but we know that it's just temporarily. As wind blow, it will just change its shape. And when it merge with other piece of cloud, there's no conflict at all. They are all in harmony. Yeah, if your aeroplane flows through the cloud, in fact, you don't see the same thing. There's just water vapor. So same thing with a lot of things that we see in life, they are basically causes and conditions. It's just that causes and conditions are in a temporary stable state, we tend to box them up, including ourselves. We box ourselves up, we live in this box, we feel more secure within this box. And we start to develop a very strong self-centeredness. This is my box. And we did not realize that even within this box, everything is causes and conditions are subject to change. And in fact, this box that we have drawn for ourselves, initially you draw a dotted line and then solid line and then boy. And you become more and more self-centered and you want to protect this eye more and more. And you start to see other box clearly. And you did not realize that if you open up all these lines, you can actually merge with others. In harmony, there's no conflict. Just like the cloud. You take away this line, it merge together with others, there's no conflict at all. It's just causes and conditions. But because our state of mind is not at that state as yet, and also habitually we have developed this strong self-centeredness. So we are just like a piece of matter. When we see causes and conditions together in a temporary state, immediately we pull them together. And then we immediately label it and then cling on to it. And to many things that we see. So, the Buddha tried to tell us that we actually fall into the trap of attaching to the appearance and then develop self-centeredness. So, as an ordinary person, when we are practicing, we listen to the Buddha's teaching, listen to some of this teaching, impermanence, self, non-self, causes of suffering, and we feel that it makes sense. All right. So some people then say, yes, I want to try to practice. The Buddha has proved that practice is possible. It is possible to attain enlightenment. So they develop the renounced mind, to free from afflictions, free from self-centeredness. All right. So when they start to, they have this renounced mind, they still have not attained any state, so they start to listen, try to practice upholding precepts, practice meditation, listen to teachings, right? And so by practicing, and then finally they realize the truth, realization of truth. The truth of non-self, the truth of impermanence, the truth of all the causes of suffering. All right? So they realize that this body is actually not necessary to attach to, and also they develop full confidence in the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, that the causes of suffering come from greed, hatred, ignorance, and they have no doubts about it. The teachings are impermanent, no doubts about it. They see the truth of it. And they also understand the teachings of non-self. All right, so that's realization of the truth. Now, so in between here, there were people who developed the renounced mind. They will try to practice diligently, upholding precepts, meditation, and so on. So we say that there are 37 grades of practice. Okay, so it includes the four foundation of mindfulness. That is basically practicing, contemplating on the truth of this body, the sensation. What's the truth of sensation? What's the truth of so be mindful of the changes in our mind, and also try to understand mindfulness on the truth of all phenomena. So that's the four foundation of mindfulness. Some of you have heard it, some of you may have not. And then there's the fourfold diligence, so four right efforts, so four folds of right effort. Okay, you want me to write it down for you? I'm not going to go into detail, but I'm just going to just name them. Okay, it adds up to be 37 grades of practice. So one is four foundation of mindfulness. And then the fourfold so the four folds of diligence. First is the effort that we need to put in to reframe unwholesome thoughts, speech, and actions from arising. And secondly, to put in effort to stop the unwholesome speech and action that's already arisen from continuing. Okay? So first is that you have to prevent them from arising. For those speech, actions, and thoughts that already unwholesome speech, actions, and thoughts already arisen, we have to put a stop to it. For example, you are already very greedy, halfway eating. No, so you have to stop. Or you start to swear at others. You're angry. You have to say no more. Don't continue anymore. You really need to tell yourself to have this effort to remind yourself no more second word. Because when you are angry and you've already swear, if you don't try to control yourself, the third sentence that comes out will be harsh, and then it's going to create more problems. So at that time, you need to put an effort to it. And then also the effort that we need to put in to make sure that we know that we are stronger in our jealousy. So you know that when I see this person, I will always get very jealous with this person. So before you see him, try to calm yourself and say, okay, no, I'm not going to be jealous today, and try to prevent the unwholesome speech, action, and thought from arising. So upholding precepts is actually a good way to help us with this. Because by upholding precepts, we try to remind ourselves there are certain actions that's not right. So we remind ourselves, no, I need to abide to the rules, and it's actually not right to go beyond that. Okay, and then also the effort that we need to put in to cultivate more wholesome speech, actions, and thoughts, and also the effort that we need to put in to maintain and develop further the wholesome speech, actions, and thoughts that we already have. So for those that we have not developed, say for example, you may sit down meditating for 5 minutes every day, then you may want to tell yourself, I need to be a bit more hardworking and spend, and say, okay, I want to extend it to 10 minutes every day or something like that. All right, so that is extra effort to cultivate more wholesome speech actions and thoughts or practice. And then the to maintain is also important. You have been sitting for 10 minutes every day, and then you find that, oh, I want to be lazy. So you need to actually put in effort to make sure that you maintain and even develop further. Okay, so that's four folds of diligence. And then third is the four cultivation of supernatural power. Now, this the practice that these four practice are basically the foundation that allows a person to attend some jhana and concentration, and also set a foundation to develop supernatural power. So it's basically the will to practice, and also the diligence, and the mindfulness and concentration. All right, and then. Fourth is, so we have 4, 4, 4, 12.
Sorry, so with that one, is that just four different jhana, four different states? What are the fours, or is that...
This one?
Yeah. Should we be concerned, or that's...
It's not the jhana. Okay. It's not the jhana. It's just four aspects that are more important for the development of... supernatural power. Okay, so 4, 4, 4, and then we have the 5 spiritual root. So the 5 spiritual roots is basically the faith and confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and the precepts, and then diligence, spiritual root of diligence, spiritual roots of mindfulness. Spiritual roots of concentration and spiritual root of wisdom. Okay? Now, so spiritual root, what does it mean? This is actually very important. This part of teachings is actually very important. A lot of time we learn about the teachings of the Buddha. A lot of you have been attending Dharma talk a lot of times. And or you find that after you graduated, you go to work. How many of you find your devotion towards learning the teachings can continue? Or your faith and confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha is deeply rooted in yourself. Whenever you encounter any incident in life, encounter any issue in life, do you ever remember the teachings of the Buddha? Or you remember and have confidence in that the teachings of the Buddha will guide you to the right path? How confident are you? So that's why the root, we a lot of, even sometimes I found that some devotees who have learned the teaching, who have called themselves Buddhists for 20 years, 30 years, you find that when anything happens in life, you find that they are just chaos. It just shows that when you learn the teachings of the Buddha, you didn't actually plant the root. So it's just like the tree. If the root is not deeply rooted, the root is not strong, the tree is not going to be strong. If the root is strong, then it absorbs energy, it absorbs nutrients, the right nutrition, so that's the faith and confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and the precepts, and your root of diligence. No matter under what kind of circumstances, you always have this mind that I want to make use of all the opportunity I have to learn the Dhamma. Do you have that diligence? Just like when you walk out from a lecture hall, immediately you look at your phone. Kids, 5 minutes, play games. If you have that diligence in practice, everyone's going to attend enlightenment very quickly. If my kids this day, or if you probably can, you observe this very easily in the lecture, even in the lecture hall, people start to look at, not to stay outside, is that right? Because your lecturer probably didn't. Are you allowed to look at your phone in the class, in the lecture hall? Are you allowed to?
I think you're allowed now. Yeah.
Because you're adults, yeah. But in high school, right? In high school, because the teachers are keeping their eyes very closely. So once they get out of the classroom, you find that during recess, everyone will be looking. Is that right? And then whenever they have a little bit of time, you'll play games. So if we have that diligence where we feel that life is actually not that long and the time to practice is actually not enough, and you have that diligence that wherever you are, you won't complain that there's too much assignment or too much work. You feel that this is an important task. Learning the teachings of the Buddha is also part of your homework, that you need to try to steal time from here and there to make sure that you continue to practice. Do you have that diligence? That's very important. Yeah. So because we all have a lot of responsibility every day, but then this mind of learning the Buddha's teaching is still my first priority. Although I have my responsibility, but you should have this diligence, right? So then only we have planted the root. And the root of mindfulness, be mindful on the teachings of the Buddha, and also the root of concentration. So if you practice until when you have some good experience of jhana, you find that you actually plant the root for yourself, that you have great confidence because you have experienced a good jhana before, and you really know that it is possible. And the root of wisdom. So that's the five spiritual roots. So if the root is strong, then only your tree, you find that when you plant, and it, how many of you like planting? No place to plant? You see that if the root is healthy, then the shoot looks healthy and looks like full of energy. Like in the spring, you go to Hyde Park, look at the flowers. Some flowers look like very sad. And it's because the root, if the root has got problem not absorbing nutrition and water properly, then the tree is not going to have energy. Sometimes you look at, oh, this plant looks full of energy. You see? So then the next one is the five strength or energy. The strength basically is the same as the spiritual root. There's the strength of confidence, the strength of of diligence, the strength of mindfulness, the strength of concentration, and the strength of wisdom. It is from the root that you develop this. And then the next one is the seven factors to enlightenment. So these are the seven factors which are very important for someone who has practiced, listened to teachings, have diligently practicing four foundations of mindfulness, and the five spiritual root, five strengths, and they come to the state where their minds actually quite focused. So their minds focus, and when they see anything, they are able to understand the truth of it. And so their mind, they are able to see the truth of whatever they see at that moment. And then from there, their mind is calm and focused, and they start to relate to the teachings. And then by relating to the teachings, they have some small realization. And with that realization, they then go on, they start to have a sense of peace and ease in the mind. And then with the ease of the mind and joy of the mind, then they get into mindfulness. And then finally, they come to a state of equanimity. So that's why this is the very important practice that finally leads to enlightenment. Okay? And then the next one is the Noble Eightfold Path. Alright, so we have 4, 4, 4 plus 5, 10. So that is how many? 24, is that right? 24 plus 7?
29.
Plus 8?
37.
Yeah. So there's 37 ways of practices that can help a person to attain enlightenment. Okay? The Noble Eightfold Path, but if you try to look into the details of this, they are actually basically includes cultivation of faith and confidence in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and upholding precepts, practice of concentration, diligence, mindfulness, cultivation of wisdom. So that's why if you categorize them, you'll find that the Noble Eightfold Path is actually quite complete in a sense. And that's why a lot of time, in summary, we will just say the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay? So the people who have developed the renounced mind, they practice diligently these practices until they realize the truth of non-self, have full confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. Okay? So once they realize the truth, it's just like before that the Buddha tell them that above the cloud there's a sun, the sunlight, but because the dark cloud is always covering. So it's just that we all haven't seen the sun. Alright? So when you come to this state of realizing the truth, it's just that you're able to open up the cloud a little bit and see the sun, experience the sun. So you gain full confidence that yes, I know that is possible. There's the sun up there. Does it make sense? So it's just like you got. You got the sun up there, but there's a lot of cloud at the bottom here, right? So we are all practicing, listen to Buddha's teaching, but we haven't experienced any truth ourselves. And that's why you sometimes got hesitation. But when you come to this part, it's just like they are able to open up a bit of gap and really see through the sun a bit themselves. And so they experience that, and it gives them full confidence that it is possible. All right? So this, when they realize this part, this is what we call the first fruition in the practice of the path of liberation. And then after they attend the first fruition, it doesn't mean that's the end, because after they attend the first fruition, it's just that they have experienced the truth, but then there are still some other part that they need to polish up. For example, they may still have some greed and hatred that need to be polished up, some small attachment, afflictions that need to be polished up, all right? So then they have to go through second fruition, and then third, and then finally the fourth fruition is the arahat. Okay? So when they attend the state of arahat, that's where they attend the state of nirvana, where they realize perfectly the teaching of non-self, and also they understand that there's no fixed entity that we can hold on to. A lot of time we say we see things as that this rise and fall. Why do we say it rise and it fall? In fact, we when we talk rising and falling, we are actually thinking of this as a thing. That this thing appear, we say it rise. When this thing disappear, we say it falls. But when you come to the state of realizing non-self perfectly, you understand that there's no fixed entity at all. There's no I that you can cling on. So what is rising and falling? When you can say something rise and something fall, it's only when there's a fixed entity. So when you take away the concept of self altogether, there's no self. It's just causes and conditions that keep on moving. There's no fixed entity as such, so what is rising and falling? Does it make sense? Very difficult. So that is the state where they realize there's neither rising nor falling. So yesterday I gave an example that, like in this room, all right? We said before that, we off the light, it was dark. When you on the light, it's bright. Now, have you moved the darkness away outside? I'll put it that way. That way it's dark. so that you put the brightness in here. So darkness and brightness is not fixed entity as well. They are just causes and conditions. They are not fixed in identity. They are causes and conditions. They are impermanent. When you change the conditions, then it just changed it. So it doesn't mean that when we attend Nirvana, you move the ignorance away to somewhere else. Ignorance itself arises due to causes and conditions as well. When you change it, it's just like a piece of puzzle, many pieces. This picture is not nice, slowly we change bit and pieces, slowly it changes to another picture. There's no fixed entity as such. Alright? So it is only when we fall into the trap of holding to a self that we say things rise and fall. But when there's no fixed entity, there's no rising or falling. So that is the state of Arahat, and this is the path from the renounced mind. Now, so a person who attends Arahat, usually we say they have a still mind. A still mind as such. So they will not be very, very proactive in the open heart section, because they have been diligently, their main study, because when they set their mind, is that what they want, their priority in practice is to make sure that they free themselves from afflictions. They want to renounce from all afflictions and attend Nirvana. So there's only one task, and that's why when they come to this state of realizing non-self, free from all afflictions, they say that they have accomplished all tasks, and that's why we say they are at the state of no more learning is needed. Some of you may have read some Agama Sutra that this is come to the state of that no learning is needed, all right? Because they have accomplished the task, and that's why they enter Nirvana, stay at the peace, at the state of peace and ease. But some people will say, so where is Nirvana? Did they move to another world? Do you think they have moved to another world?
No.
No. So where are they? Where are they?
It's inside you.
It's inside you. Okay. All right. So
I
Nirvana.
It's still another problem.
Yeah. So it's just like the darkness and the brightness, I say. All right. So if you realize and light, you realize the truth, you're free, right at that moment, and that's it, right? So that is just that's a state of Nirvana. You do not need to go anywhere else. Yeah, in fact, as we say, afflictions, having afflictions and attend enlightenment, they are not two things. It is by eliminating the afflictions, then when you realize the truth, it doesn't mean that the afflictions is one thing that you need to put into the rubbish bin, and then you have to look for body and then put into here, right? They are not as such. So Nirvana is basically a state of mind, a state of realization, a state of peace and ease after you are able to transform yourself, your impurity into purity, and that's it, and realize the truth of non-self. All right, so that is the renounced mind. So, but then the question now we have is that how can a person have a still mind and still have an open heart? So by following this path, the open heart part is not really open. So there's another type of people who develop the body mind. So after listening to the Buddha's teaching, they feel that it is important for us to learn from the Buddha, not only purifying themselves, attend liberation themselves, but also see the example of the Buddha, how the Buddha attained enlightenment, and try to help and guide all sentient beings. Because after the Buddha attained enlightenment at the age of 35, he continued to walk along the two banks of Ganges River and teach people, going through the toil and trouble to teach and make sure that everyone learned the teachings. And also he tried to form the Sangha order to make sure that the teachings can be prolonged generation after generation. And that's why while we are able to learn the Buddha's teaching today, we should actually appreciate the compassion of the Buddha and the wisdom of the Buddha in how he formed the Sangha order and make sure that the teachings can be prolonged. Because if he do not have this thought that I want to help and guide sentient beings and even sentient beings generation in the future, then he just entered Parinibbana. But he did think of how he wants to help as many people as he can. And that's why there are people, after learning the Buddha's teaching, they feel that, yes, causes of suffering come from our greed, hatred, jealousy. Yes, it's very true. But the bodily example of the Buddha in helping and guiding others is something that we need to appreciate as well. So this is especially after Buddha's Parinibbana, more people feel about the difference. That how, when the Buddha was around, he gave warmth and support to people. There are a lot of great disciples of the Buddha during Buddha's time. And even after the Buddha entered Nirvana, you'll find that there are still quite a lot of arahats at that time. Right? But then people feel that, how come these people are so good in their practice, but we don't feel the warmth and comfort as what the Buddha gave us? When you go with you go to the Buddha, you feel that you feel so peaceful, and you feel so that he's so understanding, and that he gives you warmth and support. So people start to recall the bodily example of how he helped others. There are stories in the sutra that says that there were monks who were sick, and the other monks were just diligently practicing meditation themselves. No one went to care for this monk. And the Buddha went to this monk. He was so sick that he can't clean himself. The Buddha helped to clean himself. The Buddha helped to boil medicine for him, and so on. And there were also a monk who gone blind, and he was trying to ask people to come and help him to thread the needle. And no one comes. Everyone's meditating. But Buddha came and helped. So there are this bodily example that some people sort of recall and say, these are also very important. Especially Buddhism, the Buddha left the palace in search of the truth to help everyone to relieve from suffering. Of course, the ultimate way of helping everyone to relieve from suffering is that if everyone can attain realization and end the cycle of life and death, which is the greatest suffering. But then, before that state, some people, the ordinary people, sometimes they have sufferings in their real life. So if we only tell them that, don't worry about this, practice, don't eat, practice, it's not practical in a sense, right? So helping and guiding others is still very important. There was this story, it's actually a real incident that a monk told us when I was studying in Taiwan. He went to Thailand and he renounced as a monk in Thailand. He was in a forest, in a forest monastery. Everyone was very diligently practicing. And so one day there was a man that came together with a boy to the monastery. He looks pretty sad. And then he went in, he paid respect to the Buddha, he looked around, he stayed for a while, but no one's going and say hello to him and what do you want and things like that. So everyone's sitting under the tree here and there, you know, they all stay in the kutip or where. And so he didn't manage to get anyone to talk to him. And the second day he came along again. Looks very sad. And the third day he came again with the boy. And so this monk, he feel, this person looks like very sad. It must be, it looks like he's looking for someone to talk to. So he went forward to talk to this person. Then this man said, if I didn't manage to talk to anyone today, he actually has a bottle of poison with him that he's going to commit suicide. And after the incident, this monk feel that, what is the purpose of us practicing the teachings of the Buddha? Is this just for ourselves? There's someone who is in great suffering, not necessarily helping the person to attain final liberation as yet, but should we give them a helping hand? And so that was the question he asked, and then later he actually go to a Mahayana Sangha order and renounce it. But anyway, so that's the Bodhimaya. The Bodhimaya of sharing the feelings of others. So a person, so there are people who, after listening to the Buddha's teaching, feel that purifying the mind is very important. But then having the compassion is also helping and guiding others is also very important. So they have two tasks. This one have one task, that is to renounce some affliction. This one has got two tasks. One is to, so their only task is to renounce some afflictions and attain liberation. So this one is to renounce from affliction and also help and guide sentient beings. Okay, so they have two tasks. So with the body mind as an initial motivation, so they develop body vow and they practice the six perfections. Have you talked about six perfections yet? Not yet?
Last week.
Last week. Okay, so that's good. So they develop body mind and then practice six perfection, six paramita, and the four immeasurables. So they practice meditation, but one of the emphasis was the four immeasurables, and also the four embracing virtues of helping and guiding others. Alright, so the six perfections, six paramita, you know what are they? Practicing of generosity, upholding precepts, patience,
morality.
That's the precepts, yeah.
Okay.
So, effort, yeah, diligence, and then meditation, and wisdom. So six. And then the four immeasurable, that is actually a form of, four immeasurable is a form of meditation as well. So if you want to practice four immeasurable very well, then you'll be that you attend fourth jhana, then you practice the four immeasurable. But usually we also practice four immeasurable as in the daily form. So four immeasurable is the practice of loving kindness, practice of compassion, practice of appreciative joy, and practice of equanimity. All right. So loving kindness, as I said before, is to give happiness to others. We wish others to be well and happy. Always wish, have this good heart that whoever you see, every morning tell yourself, I want to wish myself to be well and happy, wish everyone to be well and happy. Come out from your room with a smiling face. That would be good. You find that everything will run smoothly that day. And compassion is to free others from suffering, relieve others from suffering. Appreciative joy is to appreciate the success of others. When others do well, congratulate them. Don't say, so what? I can do that still. Well, there are people who tend to have that kind of feeling, right? You feel that that person did a good project and everyone prays, so what? It's so easy. I can do better. Right? So that's jealousy. So appreciative joy overcome our jealousy. So when we in Buddhism, we usually say loving kindness and compassion. We always say practice compassion as a general term. But in detail, it actually encompasses all these four. So appreciative joy and equanimity or equality. Now, so in our at the state that we are practicing is actually more of equality, that we try to make sure that we, when we wish others to be well, others to be free from suffering, rejoice with others' success, we usually, like for example, a mom can have unconditional appreciative joy to the son if the son did well. So you definitely rejoice with that. But you probably do not rejoice with your neighbor's son if your neighbor's son did better than your son. There's no appreciative joy. Is that right? So you find that a lot of parents these days are very competitive. They always ask the neighbor, or they go to school. I have devotees who say, oh, they go to school at primary school, and during assembly, some parents were standing around listening, and after the principal had talked and the students had gone back to the classroom, the parents still hang around and say, how much did your son score in yesterday in the spelling? And they start to compare one another, and then what grade is your son learning in your piano and things like that. And so they start to compare, and there's no appreciative joy at all. So that's not good, all right? So because why do I say that when we say compassion or loving kindness in a general term should actually include all this? Because on one hand, you say, I wish everyone to be well and happy. Now, when other people are doing well, why don't you wish them well and happy? See? So, a lot of time when we say we wish others well and happy, it's just when we are having a good, when we're in a good mood. When you're not in a good mood, you're not wishing them. Or when the person's is doing something that's sort of competing with you, you're that wishing good wishes will not be there. So that's why appreciative joy counteract that and make sure that our wish of loving kindness and compassion can actually be more powerful. And not only to people that are close to us, but also to people that we do not know, people that has been unfriendly to us. We wish them all well. All right. So the four immeasurable usually starts the loving kindness and compassion and also appreciative joy. If we want to practice, we usually start from people who are close to us because it's easier to radiate loving kindness. Like I think most of you have practiced metta before. It's easier for you to radiate loving kindness and compassion to people that you love, that you care about, and then to people who are not so close to you, and then even to people who have been unfriendly to you, and then to everyone in the world. So we radiate, we sort of expand the scope. But for the practice of equanimity, it will be better to start from people that you do not know, that wish them well, and then bring it back, because otherwise you find that it is very difficult for you to have an equal mind. Okay? So when we still have a self-centeredness, you find that when we send our wish a goodwill, it is difficult to be very equal in a sense. And our mind of is actually not as a state of very, it's very difficult to be very, very balanced, but we will try. Okay? So that's the four immeasurable. So a person who developed the body mind, they practice six perfection, four immeasurable, four embracing virtues are ways to relate with people. So there's practice of generosity, loving speech. So loving speech means that gentle in your speech. Speech that's encouraging others, make people feel happy. And then also beneficial acts that's benefiting others and working together with others. So four embracing virtues is basically to encourage people to work together with others. Not to just isolate yourself, but like, for example, you have learned some good teachings of the Buddha, like this universal members, you try to encourage your friends to come along, work together with everyone, and while you're working together, you try to encourage one another and share the teachings together, right? So that's for embracing virtues. So they develop the body mind, they practice this, and not only the six perfection, four immeasurable, four embracing virtues, they should also try to cultivate the understanding of non-self and emptiness. Understand the teachings of impermanence, selflessness, and what does mean by that everything arises through causes and conditions and in the process of changing. So sometimes we use the word emptiness to describe a state as such. Okay? And so once they realize the truth of non-self and emptiness, that's the time that they attend the first stage in the practice of the Bodhisattva. So then with this first stage of the Bodhisattva, now that they have realized non-self, but because before they attain the state of non-self, non-attachment, they already have this great compassion in helping and guiding sentient beings, and the practice has been encouraging them to develop compassion and wisdom hand in hand. And that's why when they attain the state of non-self, they're still able to be motivated by their compassion to help others. Because their task, they have two tasks, to renounce some afflictions and to help and guide all sentient beings. So after they have realized the truth, attain the first stage of the Bodhisattva practice, they will continue to practice the six perfection, four immeasurable and four embracing virtues, but now with in a state of non-self. So in a state of non-self, when they practice the four immeasurable, you find that it is easier to, it is basically, will, they will be able to practice with mind of equanimity, where the mind is, that you don't attach to yourself, you don't attach to the sentient beings, but you understand that they need help and you try to help them. So we say that this kind of help, how does it work? It's basically like, we say that the Buddha and Bodhisattva are like someone who have awakened from the dream. Anyone of you have nightmare before? Scary nightmare? Yeah, sometimes you scream at night, or you have seen little brothers and sisters having nightmare. So when they have nightmares, people in the nightmare, they scream, and sometimes they wake up, they still cry, scary, right? So, but as a person who is awake, you look at them, you know that what is in the dream is not real. So, but then to them, they are crying like mad. So you will try to wake them up. Hopefully they wake up and tell them this is not true, it's okay. Alright? So same thing we say, so the Buddha and Bodhisattva, although they know that in fact each of these sentient beings is not as fixed entity as it is, and the sufferings are actually causes and conditions, it's not real things that they can attach to. But for sentient beings, ordinary people who have not realized the truth, they tend to cling on to themselves as real, they cling on to the suffering as real as well. And that suffering is actually very intense to them. So a Buddha and Bodhisattva have realized non-self, they have gone through the experience. So they share the feelings of these sentient beings and they try to wake them up. Because they themselves realize non-self, so they are able to treat everyone with equanimity and not having any attachment because their mind is just peace and tranquil. Okay, so after they have attained the real light first stage, they'll continue to perfect all these practices of six perfections, six paramita, four immeasurable, four embracing virtues. And so the stages Bodhisattva path is slightly different. So when it comes to this part where the Bodhisattva realize non-rising and falling, that there's no more. Because when someone attend the first fruition, second fruition, third fruition, they may still, because of some minor afflictions that they still have, they may still continue to go around the cycle of life and death for a few times. It was said that in the first fruition, they may still go around heaven and human realm for seven times, and then the second will be probably one time, and then the third one, and probably just no more return. And so the same thing with the Bodhisattva practice. They'll continue to perfect their practice of upholding precept, generosity, tolerance, and so on, with the realization of non-self. And so for the Bodhisattva path, there's up to this stage where they realize non-rising nor falling, perfection of the teachings of emptiness is the eighth stage of the Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva practice will continue for 9, 10, and then there's some cultivation before attain Buddhahood. So, this basically shows how the practice comes about, and that how can we have a still mind and continue to care for others, it basically says that, basically remind us that we need to, if we want to have a still mind and at the same time be able to care for others, the cultivation of loving kindness and compassion, develop the body mind before your mind becomes still, is important, so that the compassion will still become the compassion and your body vow will become a motivation for you to then apply the wisdom of non-self in helping and guiding others in a more perfect way. So they need to cultivate loving kindness and compassion before the still mind, and also develop wisdom. And having wisdom and compassion as the drive, a still mind will continue to help others with an open heart, selflessly. So you can also see that the four immeasurables, very important, because the four immeasurables in Buddhism, in the Sravaka practice, the attained arahat, they look at the four immeasurables as the, just a way of practice of cultivating good merits. In the Sravaka practice on view on the Sravaka practice views on the four immeasurables is that it can help a person to create good affinity with one another, reduce individuals' afflictions, and also cultivate good merits that allows you to be reborn in the heaven or in the human realm. But in the Mahayana views is that in order to practice the four immeasurables to the perfect state, in fact, you need to realize selflessness and non-self. Because it is only when it's non-self that you're able to radiate your loving kindness and compassion to the state of equanimity. So equanimity, the state of equanimity is actually a state of wisdom, of non-self. So because when you start to wish others to be well and happy, appreciate the success of others, you broaden your mind all the time. And when you start to share the feelings of others, wish others to be well, you find that indirectly you reduce your self-centeredness. Because if your self-centeredness is strong, it is difficult to break through. So it is by practicing as such that you always wish others to be well, you share the feelings of others, try to relieve from others from suffering, that you put yourself as you don't just think of yourself as the most important anymore. So in that way, you reduce your self-centeredness until finally you realize that this self-centeredness actually cannot be hold on to. There's no self-centeredness that you can cling on to, that you realize non-self. And when you realize non-self, and because of the cultivation of compassion and loving kindness that you have been practicing, then at that time you find that you're able to radiate your loving kindness and compassion boundless, to immeasurable beings without any obstruction, without any barrier at all. Okay, so that's where you find that the immeasurable can actually lead to the realization of selflessness, non-self, and enlightenment. So when we practice, when we practice loving kindness and compassion, you find that there are also stages how your loving kindness and compassion develops. Loving kindness and compassion, so the first type is that we tend to see the person in suffering, so we develop loving kindness and compassion to the person. The second type is to come with a bit of wisdom, some people do understand that this human being or these beings is a combination of causes and conditions. They are in the process of changing. They are not as fixed as it is. But then this I which is non-real, but this combination of the five aggregates to them, five aggregates is still real. Although this I is not real, but five aggregates is real. The suffering is real. The cycle of life and death is real to them. So they attach to this illusionary I as seeing that there's still suffering that go around the cycle of life and death. So therefore, they develop loving kindness, try to free these illusionary sentient beings from suffering. And the third stage is the unconditional loving kindness of the Buddha and the Bodhisattva, where they realize non-self, and they realize that in fact everyone are just causes and conditions. They just want to wake everyone up, and they have no attachment and it's unconditional. So it's just like they are part of yourself, because it's just like the cloud. If you take away the line, in fact every part is just like part of you. So you will just try to fix up, for example, you feel that this hand is painful, you try to just fix up this pen. So wherever it is, it's actually like part of yourself. Okay? So that's unconditional loving kindness. So come back to the four immeasurable. So it says that the four immeasurable is the loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity. So equanimity is a word that you probably need a bit more explanation. So because sometimes people explain equanimity as equality, some people explain equanimity as indifference. Indifference seems to have a very negative connotation, right? So equanimity is basically a state of wisdom that is free from discrimination. It's free from discrimination, that is tranquil and calm, so that you don't cling on. It's a state where that's equal, that you treat everyone equally, but at the same time you don't have any attachment, you don't cling on to entity as such. So it's a state of peace and ease, tranquil and calm. So a mind of equanimity, so it is with this mind of equanimity that the four immeasurable can be done in a perfect way. So usually when we talk about the four immeasurable, we start with, if you look at the sutra, usually it starts with just talking about that we radiate, and then make sure that it's equal. We radiate our loving kindness and compassion to everyone equally. So because equanimity is not just superficially equality, it also relates to the mind and the wisdom. So it is a bit more of more than just equality. Okay. So when we talk about a still mind and an open heart, it is possible for them to work together, but it relies on your compassion and your body-mind. So the practice of the body-mind, compassion, right in the beginning, and then with the cultivation of wisdom, and then finally with the wisdom and compassion together, then only you can have a still mind and an open heart together. So you're able to practice your loving kindness and compassion with a mind which is peaceful, tranquil, equal, non-discriminating. That's just that you yourself is always at a peaceful state. Although you're calm and peaceful, but you're not cool and cold-blooded, you're able to give happiness to others. Okay? Is there any questions that anyone would like to ask? Is it very confusing? Yes?
No, I just want to ask, if a person that is practicing on the path of the Arahat, is it possible that he might change
yes.
to practice on the path of the Buddhist?
Yes, it is possible. It says that even up to here, it is possible for them to sort of change and develop more compassion and then divert the path to here and go on to Buddhahood. It's just that the further you are, the more difficult it will be for you to divert, because the habits has become strong. It's just like all of us, some of you may say, oh, why is it impossible? It's not impossible, but it's more difficult. It's just like if, for example, if I have the characteristic of being quiet, I do not like to go socializing and things like that. And if you keep encouraging me to go to a birthday party, you find that it's very difficult. I do want to divert out. right? So not to say people who have practiced years, lives and lives, and having this kind of habits, not only the cultivation, but the cultivation has become part of their character, that you find that they just do not like to deal with people. So that's why the further they go, the more they are diligent in practicing, they may understand in theory, but sentimentally it's difficult to divert. And that's why we say it's after attending first fruition, there are still things to polish up. Part of them are the habits they have developed, and also some of the hatred, greed, not necessarily those greed of the five desires, but some other attachment to certain practice and so on. All right. So and that's why there are still things that need to be polished up, and then those are more of the sentimental part. Any other questions? Yes.
I mean, it's clear that everyone wants to get to Nirvana because it's the state of enlightenment, and it's good. I mean, it's good for yourself. Regarding to the body mind, what's the benefit of me being compassionate? Why do I want to help other people? Like, do I get the benefit from helping other people? Like, why do we need to practice body mind, whereas we just focus on Nirvana mind? Yeah. And why do I need to help other people?
Okay, so why do you need to help other people?
Yeah, instead of focus on the other branch, which is practice on getting to the Nirvana and having the wisdom.
So if the Buddha did not help you, how can you help other people? How can you help yourself? So just think about that, how the Buddha attained enlightenment and he still helped us. So now that we are using his teaching and just to help ourselves, do you think it's fair? And just like if you want to practice for yourself, there are also other people who support your life so that you can practice. And we are only practicing for ourselves. Now, when you're practicing diligently, you need people to offer you food, offer you accommodation. Do you have any sense of appreciation to these people? Do you like them to also be able to benefit something from the teaching?
So it's the responsibility for you to get them on the same pathway with you. So
it's that when we have good teachings that can help ourselves, then we should try to share it with others. It sounds pretty selfish that I now have a good teaching, I only want it for myself to attain liberation. And secondly is that if everyone just want to practice and attain liberation themselves, we probably would not have Buddhism today. If no one wants to say, this teaching is good, as now that we have learned the teachings, we all become the Buddha's disciple or the students of the Buddha, we should actually have the responsibility to try to do our part to prolong it so that, because people in the past has tried to study and try to pass on the teaching, and that's why we have it today. And now it comes to our generation, we should also do something so that it can pass on. Yeah. So, and especially when talk about self-centeredness is the main cause of suffering. When we start to only think about ourselves, you find that this is part of the self-centeredness as well. Is that right?
How is that a part of self-centeredness?
Oh, because we only think about ourselves.
Yeah.
That I want to be free from suffering. So that's why the practice of four immeasurable is a way to, of course, practicing diligently, meditating, and then coming on mind and let go of self, you can also reduce the self-centeredness. So the four immeasurable is actually a practice in action. Not only, so the four immeasurable can be practiced as meditation, it can also be practiced in action. And then in action, when you carry out, you find that you actually force yourself, or it's actually a real practice that tell yourself you need to polish away the big self that you have. When you deal with people, you find that when you help others, why should I help? I've got more assignment to do. Why do I help? It's such bad. So, but then if we relate to the teachings, then we say, okay, why do I get so upset? Didn't I have some free time today? And can't I be a bit more patient? Why am I not patient? Because I do not like to do this. So it's all about I and I and I. We realize that there's a lot of I in us. So that's why in theory, sometimes it's easy to understand. And even in meditation, radiate is also quite easy. But in action, sometimes it's difficult. And that's why the Bodhisattva path, besides the body, mind, and practice of four immeasurable as in meditation, they need to also transform it into action. So the loving kindness and compassion in action. And especially when they go to this stage of realization, the Buddha and Bodhisattva basically have to transform the loving kindness and compassion into action in helping and guiding others. Yes?
But can't arahants still help people to free themselves from suffering?
Yes, they can. Yes. So the arahats, we are not saying that, in fact, don't misunderstand the arahats are not compassionate. It's just that they will not be as proactive as the Bodhisattva's practice. So arahats, if you go to them and ask them how to practice and so on, they will teach you. But it's just that if you don't ask them, they probably will be quiet. Yeah.
It's just a degree of difference in terms of determination, I assume, in terms of how much they want to help.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Because, as we say, this one has, initially when they set their vow, they have two tasks to accomplish. So they need to accomplish renouncing their own afflictions and also to help and guide sentient beings so that they need to perfect themselves in their wisdom, purity of mind, and also compassion in order to attain Buddhahood. So whereas the Arhat's path is always thinking of that free from afflictions, purifying themselves, attaining wisdom, that will actually end the cycle of life and death.
I've also read that the Buddha predicted that before the end of Buddhism, there will be no more arahants. So wouldn't that mean that arahants are still important in inspiring people?
Yes. So because people, sentient beings of different temperament, so arahants are actually should earn our respect, because if you think about ordinary people as compared to arahant, they are so well-practiced, and they are free from afflictions. They are a good example for all of us, and also shows that it is possible to practice, whether they are practicing Bodhisattva path or Arahat. They are actually like our teacher. So we should still respect them. Yeah. So when you say that there's the predictions that there will be less, it basically says that, it basically just indicates that people are not that diligent anymore. People got distracted by desires more, and that's why they are no good practitioner when it comes to the final era of the Buddha's teaching. But then again, we say everything arises due to causes and conditions, so that's why it all depends on all of us who are learning the Buddha's teaching. If we do not want this last era to come, then it is our responsibility to make sure that we promote the right teachings, encourage more people to understand the right teachings of the Buddha. Because if we don't try to tell people the right teaching, and there are also a lot of people outside who use the Buddha's name and tell teachings we are not really like really Buddha's teaching, and ends up that people thought that those teachings are the right teachings. So at the end, it may come to 1,000 years later that people say, I believe in the Buddha, but whatever they say is actually not the Buddha's teaching. Because this happened in this day's society as well, where there are cults that use the Buddha's name, but when they preach, they may even use the Buddha Sutra, but they interpret in a different way that's not in line with the Buddha's teaching. And if this type of cults become more and more popular, and we who have understood the right teachings of the Buddha do not try to stand up and try to rectify this, or try to make more people understand the right teachings, then you find that the right teachings will become diminished, and the wrong teaching will become popular, And a lot of people in the world tend to follow the popular teaching and thought that's right. Some people don't ask. They just say, oh, my mom says so, my grandma says so, or everyone is doing so. Is that the right teaching? So that's why it is the duty and responsibility of all of us as Buddhists to make sure that we protect the right teachings, make sure the right teachings is being prolonged. And that's part of the duty of, in fact, of all Buddhists, and especially for the Bodhisattva, this mind of protecting the right teachings is essential. Yes?
Does Buddhism talk about divine consciousness?
Divine?
Consciousness.
That means like people talking, telling you the future or things like that, is it? Is that what you mean?
No, divinity.
As in what?
Like a god.
God's
divinity?
Yeah. Well, in Buddhism, we do believe in divine beings, but they are not the ultimate. They are still within the cycle of life and death. Okay, so divine beings is in the heavenly realm. So there are heaven and hell in Buddhism as well. There are animals, there are hungry ghosts. There are different quality of life. But divine beings are still within the cycle of life and death. They are still there. They have not realized the truth. So they are still within the cycle of life and death. It's just that probably they have done a lot of good deeds, and that's why they are born, reborn in the heavenly beings, as heavenly beings. But they still have afflictions. Okay. Is there any other questions?